Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Without further ado, I will introduce our next speaker, who, as you know, is the Honourable Stephen Joyce, Minister for Communications, Information Technology, and, if I may be so bold, and other stuff. He has a number of portfolio responsibilities. Stephen has an interesting background, having completed a zoology degree at Massey University. He went on and did the next obvious thing to do after a zoology degree, which was starting a radio station. That was in his hometown of New Plymouth. Along with a couple of business partners, he built that up the radio works over 17 years until, as a listed public company, it consisted of 22 local radio stations and 4 national radio networks with 650 staff in 20 branches around New Zealand. In my experience of communications ministers, this makes him somewhat unique, having actually been a participant in the sector, albeit in the broadcasting sector. In 2001, Radio Works was purchased by Canwest, and Stephen retired as Managing Director in April 2001, in fact on his 38th birthday, which was a good step. I'm sure he's glad he sold it to Canwest then and wasn't trying to sell it to Canwest now. In August 2006, Stephen, more recent experience of Stephen is moving into politics, where he chaired the successful 2008 national election campaign and was successfully elected as a List MP in that election. And subsequently he's been appointed as Minister in the new Cabinet. Outside of his pressing political engagement, Stephen spends his spare time developing his 7-acre lifestyle property at Albany, where he lives with his family, together with Gemma, the retrodoodle, which I think is a wonderful name for what I presume is a dog, 2 cattle, and assorted ducks, geese, and wild rabbits. Could you please join me in welcoming Stephen Joyce to the program?
Thank you very much. Some would say the zoology degree has continued to be of use over the years. I suppose standing out there thinking, now what do you, probably there's a couple of things you want to know today, and one of them you may not get to know. But one of the things you probably want to know is, does this guy really know anything about our industry? Can I say that I have been involved in the ICT area for many, many years, but not as an ICT person. I couldn't write a piece of code to save my life, even back when writing code was what you did. They used to have a saying in my company that I knew enough to be dangerous in the ICT area. I can tell you that now, since I've got my new role, that I now have all these people at the ministry, a few of whom are over there, who have a job to make sure that I'm no longer dangerous in the ICT area. Since becoming the Minister for Information and Communication some 3 months ago, I have met with a wide range of stakeholders, telecommunications companies, ISPs, lines companies, user groups, industry groups, and other parties who are taking a keen interest in the government's approach to ultra-fast broadband. It has to be said that all of them have offered me the benefit of their experience and wisdom, and for that I am sincerely grateful. With the public release of the Castalia report the other day, I now believe that I have the full 360 degrees of available advice. Speculation has been a bit rife that today in this speech I will detail the government's plan for ultra-fast broadband and how we will roll out our pre-election commitment of fibre to the home. Sadly, if you are here today to learn the detail of these plans, then I'm afraid you will be disappointed. However, I do plan to tell you a little bit more about our thinking. And during the election campaign, our new Prime Minister and then Leader of the Opposition, John Key, committed to the rollout of ultra-fast broadband to 75% of New Zealanders, where they live, work and study within 10 years. And we set aside up to $1.5 billion New Zealand dollars for this, and we expect that to be at least matched by private sector investment. So first things first, we remain committed to this goal in government, and we have no doubt that it is achievable. When the broadband plan was initially announced, we gave ourselves the first year in government to consult and get the process right. Then within 6 years, we will have rolled out ultra-fast broadband to schools, hospitals, businesses and the first tranche of homes. And in the last 4 years, we will complete the rollout. Now, our political opponents have criticised the government for the time we are taking with this. Some think that over 3 months have passed and the $1.5 billion should surely have been ladled out by now. But I make no apologies for being cautious. This is a big investment and we cannot afford to get it wrong. It's big in terms of the money we have committed to it and in terms of the benefits it will bring to the country. So today I am planning to address some of the questions that I am asked recently on a regular basis, in the somewhat vain hope that I'll be asked them less over the next few weeks. So the first questions like, why is the rollout of ultra-fast broadband so important? Why is the government involved? Can we still afford it? And how are we going to do it? I want to spend a few moments talking about why ultra-fast broadband is, I believe, critical to New Zealand's future and what role the government has in delivering it. It's almost a cliche to talk about the tyranny of distance, and there was Brian in the Herald this morning again talking about the tyranny of distance that we are up against as a nation. But in terms of this debate, I believe it's highly relevant. Our geographic isolation, the distance between us and our competitors worldwide, has become even more significant as people think twice about the costs of travel and begin to think about their carbon footprints and other environmental issues like that. Ultrafast broadband removes these obstacles. It will put our businesses directly in meeting rooms around the globe on a regular basis. Fibre to schools will greatly enhance teaching and learning and will ensure our kids have access to the same information at the same time in a highly usable form as their peers around the world. And I have to say, I was visiting a school in Hamilton the other day who have really taken fast broadband on, and it's just so exciting. I'd go further than that and say, if we don't get that part of it right, then kids will go to school and get bored because they are playing with this stuff at home all the time. It will boost productivity in hospitals and aid medical research. Another major driver for the use of fibre to the home services will be the opportunities for home business and for people to telecommute and have telepresence. Wearing my other hat in transport, the capability for more people to work from home in a true at-work environment will take the pressure off the budget on our roads and public transport systems. In addition, ultra-fast broadband will provide the ability for SMEs using the cloud and software as a service to have large company IT support without people being on the premise. In my most recent form as a CEO of a medium-sized tourism media company, that sort of stuff is very, very important. It would mean huge productivity advances. There's also, of course, a strong likelihood of new applications being developed in the future that will require residential users to have fibre broadband connections in order to operate them effectively, particularly as increasing numbers of services are now delivered digitally. And that's likely to follow the trend we've seen in the last 10 to 15 years, where applications have evolved on the back of incremental increases in the available bandwidth. It's like an arms race, isn't it? 10 years ago, broadband speeds of up to 256 kilobits per second were required for basic web applications. And today we are talking already about broadband speeds in multiples of megabits per second, and we are seeing the development of many Web 2.0 applications, and I presume at some point somebody will arbitrarily decide that we're now on to Web 3.0. So it will ensure we will have the competitive edge we need to prosper. But the push for universal access to better broadband is not unique to New Zealand. Governments around the world are promoting strategies to improve broadband infrastructure in recognition of the important role the technology has to play in the delivery of economic and social gains. The New Zealand government believes there is a significant gap between what the market here is currently providing and is quite reasonably willing to provide and what we will need to provide if we are to remain relevant and competitive into the future. So our policy is about bridging that gap. Most of us are still reliant on copper to link us up with the main fibre backbone network. While copper was still cutting edge 10 years ago, it's a bit of a Maori Thau compared with the Ferrari fibre we need today. I think it's done tremendously well, but it ultimately will not be able to carry the amount of data at the right speed to service the internet applications that we will come to rely on over the next 10 or 15 years. Meanwhile, internet technologies are becoming more and more bandwidth hungry. In fact, the growth in global demand for bandwidth has been exponential at a rate of between 50 and 100% each year. Ultra-fast broadband should not be a luxury. It's not about online gaming or allowing the kids to download the movies quicker, although they will be able to do those things. The development of an ultra-fast broadband network will be critically important to the country's growth prospects. It will provide New Zealanders with the base infrastructure that will support advanced broadband services, including high-speed, real-time internet connections to the wider world. So what do I mean by ultra-fast broadband? By ultra-fast, I mean network access capability of at least 100 megabits per second, without contention and in both directions. And in general, only fibre will be able to provide this capability reliably. The volumes and data and the speed that copper can carry are just not comparable to fibre. So there is no doubt in my mind that the future for broadband will involve at some point replacing copper with fibre regardless. Fibre will deliver huge economic benefits for our country in terms of the enhanced productivity, improved global connectivity and enhanced capacity for innovation. And independent experts estimate these benefits will be worth between $2.4 billion and $4.4 billion a year. Now, there's been lots of estimates of that sort of thing, and I think you always got to look at these things with a certain amount of caution, but I think intuitively those numbers are there, depending on the different scenarios you use. So some commentators have suggested that it's out of character for a national government to get involved in an area traditionally dominated by private investment. Others have said that we don't need to get involved. I dispute both of those points. If there is no doubt the future of broadband is in fibre, then it is important that we get on with taking it right to the home to bring significant gains for productivity, innovation and global reach. The fact that private sector companies have decided on behalf of their shareholders not to invest in a nationwide network of fibre to the home at this point in time is a purely commercial decision and quite understandable. While that's also in a way regrettable, especially from the finance minister's perspective, as someone with experience in business, I completely understand their approach. Left to the market, the replacement of the bulk of copper access network with fibre would take a long time, possibly more than 30 years. As a country, we don't believe we can afford to wait that long. The government believes that we need to use ultra-fast broadband as a way of getting a competitive advantage over the rest of the world. And that's why we're stepping in to achieve a step change in our communication services. Having explained what we're doing and why we're doing it, I suppose the $1.5 billion question is exactly how we'll do it. And while I can't tell you the exact details yet, I do want to spend a little time underlining the five principles that will underpin and guide our broadband investment. So the first one, and these were all announced last year, was that this investment does not line the pockets or give undue advantage to existing broadband network providers. That any resulting network is open access, this is number two, so that many service providers can compete to provide broadband services over it. We believe this level of competition will provide better and cheaper services for consumers. Three, that excessive duplication of the network is avoided. Four, that everyday Kiwis get affordable world-class broadband services. And five, that this public-private partnership remains focused on New Zealand's economic future and not the legacy of our economic past. I have read and indeed believe that delivering on these principles require a carefully constructed and negotiated investment and regulatory model. As I said before, I will have more to say on this front in the next few weeks. However, I can tell you today that it is our intention to invest at the infrastructure level primarily, i.e. the provision of dark fibre infrastructure. We anticipate that that is the level that the market will not provide at this point. And government investment at that level will facilitate the competitive commercial provision of ultra-fast broadband services over fibre with the minimum regulatory intervention. One of the other common questions I get is, are we still doing this in view of the global financial crisis? The answer is resounding yes. If anything, the situation we are faced with makes it more important. New Zealand got off to a very slow start with broadband, and we now need to leap ahead if we're serious about competing. The investment in our telecommunications infrastructure will be an important part of sparking economic growth in the medium term. It will play a key role in helping to improve the productivity of the New Zealand economy as we begin to move out of the recession and into a period of growth. And could I just underline, wearing one of my other hats as Associate Finance Minister, it's the speed of which we grow after the recession that will determine the state of the taxpayer's balance sheet in 10 years' time. We won't be able to cut our costs to the point that we can balance the books. It'll be the speed at which we are able to grow that will determine how wealthy we are as a country in 10 years' time. So the government is not alone in thinking that accelerated investment in next generation broadband infrastructure is significant in the current economic climate. In the US, the economic stimulus package being debated in Congress includes plans to spend $8.2 billion on fast internet connections in urban and rural areas. In the UK, the government's interim Digital Britain report floats the following objectives: achievement of universal connectivity through delivery of a universal service commitment, a set of digital networks, both wired and wireless, that are delivering next generation access services to businesses and homes, and a digital economy that has become one of the leading destinations for inward investment in the digital and knowledge economy. The European Commission presented proposals in January as part of the EU's recovery plan to invest in key internet broadband infrastructure projects to build a stronger Europe for the long term. And of course, the reality is some of our competitor countries are already well ahead of us in the race for universal or near universal access to ultra-fast broadband and are showing no sign of slowing down. New Zealand's historically slow deployment, and I stress historically slow deployment, of fast and now ultra-fast broadband has placed a brake on our ability to take up the opportunities that the internet has to offer and will have to offer. If we don't move now, we'll be missing out on the real promise of this centuries leading technology. I want to stress today that fibre infrastructure is not the only way in which the government will support the rollout of ultra-fast broadband. That's of course the headline story of our approach to broadband, but there are many other initiatives that we can and will be taking, and I wanted to signal to you today that we're very aware of those initiatives. The provision of rural broadband services will be crucial. There's a need for considerable expansion in the ICT workforce. The expansion of fast broadband services in government-dominated areas like health and education. I don't think there's any point in the government lecturing industry about broadband take-up if it hasn't got its own house in order first. And of course, developing digital literacy among adult New Zealanders who have not yet been exposed to a way of working which is now as important as being able to read and write was 30 years ago. And I had a function with the 2020 Communications Trust a couple of weeks ago in Parliament, and can I say it was really enlightening and quite exciting and humbling to hear some of the stories of people who have been involved in those programs. So in closing, I want to stress that while the Fibre to the Home initiative is government-led and driven, this is very much a partnership with industry. There will be an opportunity for every organisation that wants one in our initiative. The rollout of ultra-fast broadband to the home, the school, the hospital and business presents real challenges and a massive opportunity for an economic and social step change. I look forward to continuing to work with you towards this common goal over the coming months and years. And I do look forward to providing the details of our plan to you very soon so that the wider industry can provide us with feedback on it before we proceed. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Minister. Now, the Minister has indicated that he's available for a few questions. So, once again, if our roving mic ladies could wave their hands. There's this question over here.
Can I stress that there'll be some that just won't be answered? Just before you ask them.
Good morning. John Derrida, telecoms economist. In Australia, the government has $4.7 billion, which they claim they want a return on. We're still not quite sure what that means. But with your finance minister's hat on, what kind of return do you expect from your $1.5 billion?
Yeah, it is a little hard to say at this point. I mean, it is an investment and we would expect a return at some point. But I think I need to talk to you about that when we talk a bit more about the plan in detail. Sorry to be evasive on that today, but if I start doing bits and pieces at a time, well, the journalists will have a big day tomorrow, but the rest of us probably need to wait and get it all out at once.
Up the back there.
Matt Crockett, Telecom Wholesale. You mentioned a number of initiatives beyond direct infrastructure at the fibre level deployment. Are you, as part of that, looking through how you can streamline some of the things needed for infrastructure deployment? And I mentioned most specifically the RMA and other things that would allow easier, faster, more streamlined deployment?
Absolutely. I think that's crucial for all players. In terms of the RMA bill that's been introduced to Parliament, there are some benefits in that. One of them is the ability, is the inclusion of network infrastructure in the potential call-in procedures, which for those of you that don't know is a maximum of 9 months once it's called in before the consent must be decided yes or no on. And there's a whole range of things around that as well in terms of speeding up consent processes. I also think there's more we can do in the area of national environmental standards, which provide consistency for technology providers across the country. And there's a job of work that the Ministry is starting to work on in terms of the opportunities that we can develop there. And there's further work on the RMA to come. I think that's crucial, regardless of who's doing it. We've got to make it a little bit easier for people to do it.
Okay, I've got a question here.
Yes, Godfrey Bridger from Counties Power. I wonder if you're able to comment at all in general, no figures, no specifics, about the possibility of the lines companies being involved in the dark fibre.
Yeah, without any specifics, I think there's only opportunity for lots of people to have an involvement, and obviously you folk have an interest in it.
We've got a question here, if we can get the microphone to the gentleman in the yellow shirt, and then we've got one over there. But I'll do the yellow shirt first, because he was...
Shane Hobson, Velocity Networks. We're the open access fibre network operator in Hamilton, which yes. Serves a school you visited a couple of days ago.
That's right.
My question is, you mentioned five principles. How do you resolve the perceived conflict between principle one, which is not to line the pockets of the current telcos,
yes.
and principle three, to avoid excessive duplication?
That is the challenge, isn't it? Well, well spotted. I'll give you a yell afterwards and get your input. It is a challenge. I mean, it's we have a reasonably fast-moving telecommunications environment. We have some very good companies that are investing significant sums of money in different parts of the infrastructure. We haven't even talked about mobile today. We have companies large and small. So the challenge for the Crown is to be involved but not to chill that investment, not to unnecessarily overbuild, and yet to achieve the outcome. It's a big challenge.
And then we've got one over here in the back.
Ray Cesar from SwiftNet. I just like to commend you first on pulling the BIF funding. That's the first one. But I've got two questions. One question is about the strategy that you're going to put in place, have you thought about the strategy in one sense about dealing with the doers and not the talkers? And the second one is, have you thought about future planning? Like, my future is that to replace that fibre optic is going to take a heck of a lot of replacement, route out 30 or 40 years, 50 years. Mm-hmm. Is there any research and development system inside the IT that you're looking at?
Just the second one. We'll deal with the first one first. I'm in favour of dealing with doers rather than talkers, absolutely. It's a sort of a default position from my perspective. Your second question I didn't quite understand. So you're talking about technology beyond fibre optics? Yeah, must get onto that. I think there's two sort of implicit questions in that. Is that whether the which technology are we talking about? And there's been a lot of debate whether the government should be technology specific or not in terms of what it's talking about. I think our perception is that the gap in the market is around the fixed area investment. That's where we believe the best way the Crown can make and support an investment. Looking out further, obviously we're all keeping a watching brief on what comes next after the technologies that we're aware of today and also the evolving natures of those technologies. I think we've got a reasonable period to see how that evolves. I think in the meantime, the technologies that we have in front of us, all of them, and wireless as well, we're sort of aware of the trajectories they're running in at the moment.
Do we have any? I've got a question over here. Sorry, I saw the hand. Sorry, have we got someone with a microphone? Gentleman here, and then I've got a lady over here. Is that the right order? And that'll probably do us. The gentleman there.
Hi, my name's Tex Edwards from New Zealand Communications. New freeways and new motorways and highways normally have new road rules. Mm. Do you see a place for new competition rules and abuse of market power rules in this new highway being built? Thank you.
Possibly, but I suppose my view is the least possible. While enhancing competition, I think there's a balance, and I think we all understand there's a balance between regulation and competition on the one hand, and encouraging and chilling investment on the other hand. And the interesting thing about this business, of course, is it's just so interconnected, and that creates special challenges. We're hoping to be in a position that the plan that we develop minimises the need for additional regulation, but that doesn't mean it won't be necessary.
Thank you.
And final question, the lady over here.
Tēnā koe, Stephen Walmer Faulkner from Tauranga o Ngāi Tahu. I'm very encouraged by your statements about commitment to rural broadband and to not being where the market is. Just wondering how that sits with your commitment to fibre to the home and whether that means that a significant amount of the investment of the $1.5 billion will be going into rural backhaul rather than to Auckland property.
Not to put too fine a point on it. The 1.5 is directed at the 75% the 75% of the country to receive ultra-fast broadband. That was declared at the time, and there's been no change in that. There is a separate fund modelled on the old broadband challenge fund in terms of rural broadband, and we'll have some more to say on that as well over the next little while. Understand that the approach is slightly different in the rural area in terms of the need for backhaul, aware of the issues, so we'll have that discussion and we'll work out how best to place that investment.
I think we might call it there, Minister, since
Absolutely.
You've given us your 30 minutes. I think you've been incredibly generous taking that many questions when you're in the middle of a process like you are. Coming from Australia, the other Stephen is actually far less forthcoming at the moment, and he's in the middle of a process.
I think you'll find when you stop to think about it that I didn't say anything.
And with that, I think you've already taken care of thanking the Minister for his time. Thank you.